Okay, good morning all. Welcome to our Breakfast in the Base. I'm the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So, full disclosure, this is a topic that I've avoided discussing for quite some time. Not because the Lubavitcher Rebbe was not one of the greatest, if not, that's certainly one of the greatest Rabbanim of the last 100 years, but because of all of the baggage that comes along with Lubavitch, that comes along with Chabad, the messianism, all that stuff. And for the purposes of the Shir, I'm going to put 99.9% of all that stuff just to not even deal with it. I hope it goes without saying, at least in this room, that the Lubavitcher Rebbe is not Mashiach, and we know that because he's dead, and the Rambam says that Mashiach has to be alive. If someone dies, then they cannot be Mashiach. There are like Lubavitchers out there who make an inference based on what the Rambam says, that the Rambam says that Mashiach can't be killed, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe wasn't killed. He died, but if you look at the Rambam, it's just not true. They're totally off base. We don't believe in resurrection, for Mashiach. That's not, we believe in the resurrection of the dead, but we believe that Mashiach is going to do that. So whatever. Long story short, I don't want to get bogged down by that, but I've avoided the topic because of all of the garbage that comes along with it. But at the end of the day, the Lubavitcher Rebbe was one of the greatest Rabbanim, one of the greatest figures in Jewish history, and there is so much to learn about him. We're only going to speak about him for a little bit, but there are books and books, and specifically the book that I used was the Rebbe by Joseph Tulishkin, so I used that book extensively for this class. And I mean, there's so many different biographies out there about him, and I just recommend that anyone should just pick up at least one of them and read them, because he was just an incredible human being, and there's everything about his life, there's just something to learn. So let's, with that in mind, so let's just begin, and we'll recognize that at the end of the day, we're not going to have a comprehensive description of his life. One of the things of being a Hasidic Rebbe, which at the end of the day, that is what the Lubavitcher Rebbe was, so the Hasidim obviously loved him incredibly, and so to this day, they still continue to perpetuate and proliferate things about his life. And so there really is like an endless amount of stuff out there. So we're going to go through the basics, from when he was born to when he passed away, and some of his Torah, but not every single detail about his life. This will probably be the least comprehensive of all the breakfasts and the bases, not because of the fact that we're doing any less, but because of the fact that there is probably more in the Lubavitcher Rebbe than any of the other figures that we've done previously. Okay, so let's begin. So in 1902, the Lubavitcher Rebbe was born. He was named Menachem Mendel Schneerson. He was born, the English date was April 18th. He was born on the 11th of Nisan in 5662. It's exciting that he was born on April 18th, because Leora, my daughter, was also born on April 18th. So remember to wish her happy birthday this year, God willing. He was born in Ukraine. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the names of some of the towns in Ukraine, because I can't even like begin to understand how to read these. He was born in Ukraine in a town called something with an N. All right, so he had two parents. His parents were Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Schneerson and Rabbi Tzinchana Schneerson, both respected individuals in the community, both incredible people. His father was a rav. His father, we'll see in just a little bit, was a pretty big rabbi. He became a chief rabbi in one of the towns of Ukraine and was there for most of his life. We're going to go back and forth between calling Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson by either Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson or the Rebbe or the Rebbe. So you'll know what I mean that when I say either of those things, but it gets a little confusing to refer to him as the Rebbe, because most of his life, or a significant part of his life, we have to refer to his father-in-law as the Rebbe, because his father-in-law was there. So we'll do our best to make sure we're making distinctions. But anyways, so those were his parents. He had two siblings. Pretty tragic what actually took place with his siblings. He was the oldest of three. His brother, who was immediately younger than him, Reb Dov Baer, so he was, as a teenager, diagnosed with schizophrenia, and he was actually institutionalized, and there's not much else that's known about him. His other brother, Reb Yisrael Aryeh Leib, actually had a PhD in mathematics, was an incredibly intelligent individual, but was unfortunately killed in a war in World War II in the Holocaust. In terms of how Reb Menachem Mendel got his name, take a look at source number one. This will kind of clear things up a little bit. So basically, all of the Lubavitcher Rebbes were related, but they were not all direct like sons of the previous one. But if you take a look at source number one, this is kind of like the family tree in a nutshell. So if you look at Reb Schneer Zalman, that's the first green box on top. That was the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, and so after him, so the current the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Nachman Mendel Schneerson, was the seventh one. So if you take a look at the third green box, which Rabbi Schneer Zalman, Rabbi Dovber, and then Rabbi Nachman Mendel, so that is the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, otherwise known as the Tzemach Tzedek. His name was Menachem Mendel, and that's where the Rebbe Menachem Mendel Schneerson that we all know got his name. He was named after him. Interestingly enough, he will actually end up marrying a woman named Chaya Mushka, and she got her name from the wife of the third Lubavitcher Rebbe. So it's just a fascinating little fun fact there. And so how are they related? So Rebbe Menachem Mendel was like a great, I think three times great grandson of the third Lubavitcher Rebbe Menachem Mendel. So let's keep going. So he was in school until the age of about 11 and a half. When he was in school, he was always kind of known as just an incredible genius, overly intelligent, beyond, so much so that by the time he reached the age of 11 and a half, they said, we got to take you out of school, we have to do private tutoring, because you're just not able to be in school with regular other students. So from 11 and a half to bar mitzvah, he had a private tutor. From bar mitzvah until, I don't know exactly how old, he had basically a charusa with his father. And again, his father was a big rav, so he learned tremendously from his father, who was not only just a general Talmud Chacham, but also a big Kabbalist, so he learned lots from his father. Interestingly, the Rebbe, something that we will see about his life, is that he wasn't just known as a Talmud Chacham, which he was, an incredible Talmud Chacham, but he was also just interested and aware and knowledgeable about all topics. He was specifically, as a child, known to be fascinated by astronomy. He was said to have had like a poster of the universe or a poster of the solar system or something like that in his room in the Ukraine when he was growing up. So he was just knowledgeable about so many things beyond the Torah world, but also just like interested. He just had a thirst for knowledge. That was kind of just the personality that he had. At the age of 7 in the year 1909, so the Rebbe's father was appointed as the chief rabbi in a city that starts with a Y in Ukraine, and the whole family moved there, and his father would be, and the family, his father would be there for the next 30 years. In the year 1917, that was when the Rebbe was 15 years old. That was the Bolshevik Revolution. So for anyone who knows Jewish history, that was a pretty significant event if you were living in the Ukraine. Ukraine fell under the auspices of the Soviet Union at that point and became a communist regime. And so at that point, it kind of became much more difficult to be Jewish and certainly impacted the next several years of Rabbi Menachem Mendel's life and certainly his father's and the rest of his family's life as well. At the age of 21 in 1923, Sir Rabbi Menachem Mendel for the first time goes to meet his distant cousin, who at that point was the current Lubavitcher Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe, known as Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson. So just a quick note about how we refer to Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson. So he was the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe. He ended up being the father-in-law of Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson. He's also known as the Friedeker Rebbe. People know that? People are aware of that term? So he's known as the Friedeker Rebbe. Friedeker, in I guess Yiddish, means the previous Rebbe. So he wasn't known as the previous Rebbe while he was the Rebbe. He only became to be known as the previous Rebbe once the current Lubavitcher Rebbe took over. So that is what he's colloquially known as. If you had to talk to Rabbi Kramer, he'll call him the Friedeker Rebbe. But he didn't get that name of Friedeker until after his son-in-law took over. But anyways, we gave away the secret. So he is the Rebbe's father-in-law, which means that he ends up, Rabbi Menachem Mendel ends up marrying Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak's daughter, Chaya Mushka. So again, they're all kind of related. They were distant cousins, and so that they got that.
Oh, yeah. Friedeker sounds German.
It's German?
The Yiddish word, Friedeker.
Okay. Oh, thank you.
Friedeker means earlier.
Okay. 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 Thank you. See, this is why I don't pronounce the Ukrainian things. All right. So now I'm only gonna stick to English and maybe a little Hebrew also, but I won't say anything else. But thank you, Arthur. Okay. So when the Rebbe met his father-in-law to be, he did not know that he was going to be his father-in-law, but he made a tremendous impression on him. There are various letters that the sixth Rebbe wrote to his daughter and to others about the greatness of this young man. He was intelligent, he was wise, he was just a sweet individual, and so many incredible things to say about him. In the year 1927, at the age of 25, Rabbi Menachem Mendel's father-in-law-to-be, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, was arrested in Leningrad, and he was and he was imprisoned and then sent to exile to be released shortly thereafter. But it was a significant event because of the fact that the Rebbe at that point also had some of his family members, including his daughter Chaya Mushka, go with him. After this period of being imprisoned and being put into exile, so Rav Yosef Yitzchak and his entire family, they all moved to Latvia, because basically being where he was just it was not safe at that point. So they all end up in Latvia. In October 20th of 1927, Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson completely leaves Russia with some of the rest of his family, and the Rebbe Nachum Mendel in particular also goes with him. There was a big to-do, like, why should Rebbe Nachum Mendel, who he still was not married to Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak's daughter at that point, so why should he leave? And he basically made that, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak basically made a comment saying that, I need him to come because he's going to be my son-in-law. And they said, just get another son-in-law in the next place you go. And he said, you can't find a son-in-law like this anywhere else you go, so he has to come with us. So he ended up coming with them. Rabbi Nachum Mendel, when he left with Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak and the rest of that family, so he left. So Rabbi Nachum Mendel left his family, his parents. He would actually, when he left, this was at the age of 25, he would never see the rest of his family ever again. His mother, he actually would see, and she would end up moving to America years later, but his father, he would never see. And there's actually a story, we'll just say it quickly now, that basically, it's tragic what ends up happening to Rabbi Nachum Mendel's father. Because he ended up staying in that area, he was put into exile, and then he ends up dying, I think in Kazakhstan or something. He ends up dying there while he was in exile by the government. And incredibly, there was a picture of Rabbi Nachum Mendel's father in his older years when he was already sickly. I think he ended up dying of cancer. And there's in the back of one of the pictures of supposedly the Rebbe's father, there was like a question mark that the Rebbe wrote, was like, I think this is my father. Because he didn't even know what his father looked like towards the end of his life, because he was so sickly and he hadn't seen him in so many years. But so basically, he doesn't see his father ever again. His mother, like I said, does end up reuniting with him 20 or so years later, once they're all in America. Let me just see something. Okay, good. Yeah. So once they left Russia, once Rabbi Nachum Mendel left with his father-in-law to be his family, Chaya Mushka, etc. So it's a well-known fact that no Lubavitcher Rebbe has ever stepped foot back in Russia since then. They left Russia in 1927, never came back, but neither his father-in-law nor the Lubavitcher Rebbe never came back to Russia. One of the reasons probably why the Lubavitcher Rebbe never went back to Russia was because, another well-known fact, the Lubavitcher Rebbe only left New York City after he moved to America, after he moved to New York and he became the Rebbe. He only left New York City three times in his entire life after that point, for like the last 40 some odd years of his life, and he only left to go like upstate New York. So he really did not travel much in general. By the age of 26, in the year 1928, so the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Nachum Mendel, started a school in the University of Berlin. Like we said, he was not just an incredible Torah scholar, he was an absolute genius in so many other areas, and he studied engineering both at the University of Berlin, and several years later he would end up in Paris with his wife. We'll see that they get married in just a second. And he ended up with a degree in mechanical engineering and in electrical engineering. So he was a very smart guy. Alan, you would have liked him. You guys could have talked shop. He was an incredibly So when he was in the University of Berlin, there are a couple of noteworthy things. First of all, just a list of some of the classes that he enrolled in. He studied philosophy, analytical geometry, higher math, experimental and theoretical physics. If anyone knows the name, I apologize if I'm getting this wrong, but I don't think I am. One of his professors was Erwin Schrödinger. So if anyone's ever heard of Schrödinger's cat, are you familiar with that? It's like Schrödinger's cat. It's like, yeah, you're familiar? It's like a thing in quantum physics about how we could assume if a cat is alive, if he's in a box. Look it up on Wikipedia later. So he was one of his professors. He was a Nobel Prize winning physicist, and just did. It gives you a sense of like who he was learning from. While he was there, also, very famously, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik was in the University of Berlin at the same time. There is an incredible amount of, I'm going to call it apocryphal, knowledge about whether or not they interacted, if they had anything to do with one another. There is a story that goes that someone once made a comment to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Nachum Mendel, what his relationship was like with the Rav, and he said that we had more of a relationship than most people are aware of. But at the same time, they really have close to no interaction when they're both living in New York, I don't know, 20 minutes from each other, whatever it was. So it's a little unclear exactly what they had to do with one another, but they were there at the same time, and they likely interacted. They were both geniuses, and they were both Gedolei Hador to be, to come. So probably they had something to do with one another, but again, it's very unclear exactly what they had to do with each other. So Rabbi Nachum Mendel was there for 4 years until the age of 30. Before we get to the age of 30, at the age of 26, after he had enrolled in the school, he married his wife, Chaya Mushka, again, the daughter of the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe. How do you say it? The Friedeker? Friedeker? Whatever. Friedeker. Is there an R? It's Friedeker?
So that's the
adjective.
That came earlier.
Okay.
Priya Dicker would be the
Okay. All right, the sixth. So I was never good at languages. I never excelled at it. Okay.
What'd you say? You're right.
No, I know, but I don't know how to pronounce it, is what he's saying. Okay, fine, whatever it is. So he married Chaya Mushka, the sixth Rebbe's, the previous Rebbe's daughter. Again, he was 26, that was the year 1928. They married in November in Warsaw. It's interesting to note that, in case it's kind of hard to follow sometimes, but just so we're clear about the years, they had met 5 years previously. Rabbi Menachem Mendel went to go see Rabbi Yossi Yitzchak at the age of 20, something like that. 21, I think, 22. And when he went to meet him, so they basically stayed in contact for a number of years, but they would only marry 5 years later, which is very unusual. You don't really hear about 5 years of dating or courtship. Unclear exactly what their relationship was. You did that? Okay, fine. So you were in good company with Rabbi Menachem Mendel. Again, it's a little odd. But that's what they ended up doing, likely because of all the craziness that they went through, the exiles of the family, whatever. That's probably why it took so long. But they ended up marrying. Famously, Rabbi Menachem Mendel and his wife Chaya Mushka, they never had children. I don't believe there's actually any explanation for that, because they were, at the end of the day, very private individuals. Rabbi Menachem Mendel and Chaya Mushka, specifically Chaya Mushka, was always very private. In fact, if you look, even like you Google it, it's like impossible to find a picture of her, because they were incredibly public figures, obviously, but they were also very private about their personal lives, and so we know very little about that, but they never did have any children. And as a result of that, you can see how much each of them continues to pour into one another, how they support each other throughout all their years, and at the same time, how much they view all of their students, essentially, in the movement, as their children. In the year 1932, when Rabbi Menachem Mendel was 30 years old, him and his wife, they leave Berlin, the University of Berlin, to go to Warsaw, which is where Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak was living at that time, but just for a few months or so. After that, they moved to Paris. In Paris, France, they're there for a total of 5 years there in Paris. That's where the Lubavitcher Rebbe ends up graduating with a degree in electrical and mechanical engineering. Interestingly enough, Rebbe Tzinchaya Mushka, she also took university classes in Paris. The Rebbe, just so you're aware, he was in a few different schools. The Sorbonne was one of those schools, but he went to a couple of different places there. They were both just really smart people. And they before the Rebbe became the Rebbe, he actually just had a, well, look at there in a second, what his job was in New York, but he was just an incredibly intelligent individual. Interestingly also, they both used to talk very fondly about their years in Paris, specifically Rebbe Tzinchaya Mushka, because for this 5 years or so, when they were there, they were like anonymous, right? So Rebbe Tzinchaya Mushka, so she grew up, she was the daughter of the sixth Rebbe, so she never had a normal, regular, uneventful life. There was always something going on. And then by the time she was married to... By the time she was married, I don't know what that was. That was like a heavenly voice. By the time Lubavitcher Rebbe becomes Lubavitcher Rebbe, so then their life becomes very public. These 5 years or so in Paris, they were like unknown. They were kind of just regular citizens. So they both used to talk fondly of those years. Just to note where we are. So this is at the age of 30 that he goes to Paris. That they go to Paris. It's still another 18 years until he is the Lubavitcher Rebbe, so there is some time to fill over here. Interestingly enough, Rav Yosef Yitzchak seems to note pretty early on that whether or not his son-in-law would be the next Rebbe was maybe not so clear at that point, at least. But he was always pushing his son-in-law to go into to sort of step into the public role, as it were. And it's amazing over the years how much Rav Menachem Mendel did do for his father-in-law and did do for the Lubavitch cause in general. But he was always very humble. He always took sort of like a backseat, never was allowing his name to be printed in public, never really wanted to have much of a public role. If you look in source number two, this is actually somewhat of a source of contention in the family. And specifically what I mean by that, so one of the interesting things about Lubavitch is that this probably is true about other sects of Chassidus as well, but it's more well known with Chabad, because Chabad is Chabad. And that is that there's like all these records of letters that they wrote and different sichos that the Rebbe gave, whatever. So if you look at take a look at source number two, we're not going to go through it entirely, but it's a letter that Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak wrote to his daughter. And in the letter, let's just see if we can find it. So if you're looking at it, on the right side is Yiddish, and then it was translated, I guess, subsequently into Hebrew. And it's a letter that he wrote to his daughter. I just want to find the paragraph. Let me see. Okay, yeah. So if you take a look at the third paragraph, so the Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak was so adamant that his son-in-law would push himself into the public limelight that he started asking his daughter to push her husband into the public limelight. And so he writes, so we'll read the Hebrew, because as Arthur has explained, I really have no idea how to say anything in Yiddish. So in the paragraph, let's skip to... Let's skip to the third to last line here. Everyone's with me on page two, the left side, and the third to the last line. So he says, Chasni Yakiri, the Chavibi Harav Rabbi Nachman Mendel, Yishecha Nechbar. He says, your very special husband, Rabbi Nachman Mendel, who hayab is Palos Atsuma, who me'od rotzel aroch hekeira. So he says that your husband should really put himself out more into the public eye. Who adam me'od levavi, he's just a very special and beloved individual. Me'od ohev lasos tova, ohev kavod aval adam tov, he says, I really want my son-in-law, I want your husband, Chaim Mishka, tell your husband to go out into the public limelight, because everyone's going to love him. He's just going to be an incredible individual. About Al Yidei Dibor Lo B'Shtika, he says, but if you're silent, no one's going to know who you are. So he has to go out there, he has to do, be a figure. And he says, he says, it's very harif. He says, if your husband's going to hide from everyone, he's not going to become anything. And you have no idea, he says to his daughter, how much agmas nefesh, how annoyed I am that your husband will not go out there more. He needs to want to be recognized with his damniyot misuyamot l'asher hekeiros. Let him give some shirim, let him speak publicly, let him become some sort of a figure, because essentially from the Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak's perspective, he was kind of just waiting to be discovered. Once he'd be out there, he knew there's no putting a lid on that can, so he needs to put himself out there a little bit, and then sort of everyone else, his greatness, will speak for the rest. But just to show how much Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak always pushed his son-in-law, and how his son-in-law, the Rebbe, was never very into being out there in public, and he ends up becoming the Lubavitcher Rebbe pretty soon after, but how he was just very not into that in general. In the year 1941, by the age of 39, Rav Menachem Mendel and his wife Chaya Mushka, they finally moved to America. They basically end up in America because there's no life for them. With the rise of Nazism and all that in Europe, it's just impossible for them to be there. So Rav Yosef Yitzchak, I think, goes in the year 1938, and then Rav Menachem Mendel and his wife Chaya Mushka, they go Rav Yosef Yitzchak goes in 1940. When Rav Menachem Mendel is 38, and when he's 39 in the year 1941, then they go to the whole family ends up in America. If you take a look at source number three and source number four, I don't how much time? How long have we been going? All right, we'll do it a little bit. So in sources number 3 and 4, I think it's just worthwhile to discuss a little bit the perspective that the Lubavitcher Rebbe had on the Holocaust. So, you know, Baruch Hashem, he was able to get out of Europe with his wife and with his father-in-law, and we'll see that his mother survives as well, but he experienced tremendous loss. In particular, Chaya Mushka, his wife, lost, her sister and brother-in-law, and the Rebbe lost his youngest brother, the brother we spoke about who had a PhD in mathematics, Rabbi Yisrael Aryeh Leib. So he ends up being killed when he's just in his 40s. And so he, not only did he, as a up and coming Jewish leader, you know, feel connected to the Holocaust of the tremendous loss of the Jewish people, but also very personally, he just had a lot of family losses as well. And so I think it's worthwhile to look at two things. First of all, is source number 3 on page number 4. So this is a sicha. The reason why I thought this was especially relevant is because this was a sicha. The Rebbe used to give like sichot, like he used to give like speeches and drashas, whatever. And this was one I was given on Parshas Vayechi that we had this past week. So I thought it was nice to mention it. And if you take a look, again, page 4, source number 3, the right column. So he says, paragraph number 3. So davar zeh chamor shebeitiem kishehakatarig al darinu zeh od motzel meish nasa toch kadei chil kvodam shal hakadoshim shenahargu al kiddush Hashem al yedei hatzidkos hashoa bekach shenesmali hamea shal ha'avonos.
So he basically goes into this long conversation about how we are to view those who passed away, or who were murdered, rather, during the Holocaust. And he basically says that there are those who want to come and say that, you know, you could explain, here's how you justify why such a terrible thing could have ever happened, but the Rebbe, which is critical that Hasidic Rebbe should take such an approach, he says, we have no idea why the Holocaust took place. We have very little comprehension of what happened. But certainly we should never say that it's because of anyone's sins that such a thing took place. And he goes on to say that these are kedoshim, those who were lost in the Shoah, and we cannot always understand why God does what he does. He did decree this, but we have no comprehension of it whatsoever. So I just thought it was relevant to understand a little bit of his Torah perspective and his theological perspective. He obviously had a strong, very strong emunah, but he said we can never understand why God would do these things. Source number 4 is similar. It's a letter that he wrote to an individual who was asking about the Holocaust, in which he tries a little bit, perhaps, to discuss, you know, what the Holocaust might have meant for the Jewish people, but he ends up concluding at the end, we're on page 7, P.S. Needless to say, the above may be accepted intellectually, and it may ease the mind, but it cannot assuage the pain and upheaval, especially one who has been directly victimized by the Holocaust. And so he basically says that even though maybe you can explain a little bit, an iota maybe of what happened, at the end of the day, there's not much that could really be explained, and we just have to accept, you know, what took place. Okay, so let's move forward. So when the Rebbe and the Rebbetzin finally arrived in America, his father-in-law, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, was already weak at that point. He was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and he was pretty sick in his last several years. So when they do arrive in America, the Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak sends like a greeting committee to come meet them when they get off the boat. And the introduction that Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak gave to the chevra that came to meet him was as follows. He says, "Let me reveal to you something of this man. He knows the Babylonian Talmud by heart, together with the commentaries. He knows the Jerusalem Talmud with all of its commentaries, and all the Rambam, and all the Likutei Torah with all of its annotations. He says, now go and greet him." So obviously we know at this point that Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak had a very high opinion of his son-in-law, but it was a really, really high opinion. Like it's clear that Rabbi Menachem Mendel was just an incredible gadol. Even before he became the proper Rebbe, he was just respected and just a Torah personality that was waiting to explode and hit the world by storm, which as we know, in a few years, he would. So when Rabbi Menachem Mendel came, his father-in-law, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, really pushed him into the limelight, because maybe in Europe it wasn't so easy to have any sort of control, but now in New York, when they didn't really know anyone except for each other, so Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak had already started building a bit of a Chabad Lubavitch empire in America. He was the Rebbe, so he was very well respected, and he could do whatever he wanted in terms of the movement. So he pushed his son-in-law into the movement tremendously. Interestingly enough, Rabbi Nachum Mendel accepted it. I don't want to say reluctantly, because it wasn't a reluctant acceptance in terms of being able to serve Klal Yisrael. Maybe there was some reluctancy in terms of having being more in the limelight, but he saw the positive impact that he could have, and so he took it. One of the interesting stories from when Rabbi Nachum Mendel took one of his leadership roles in the early years, before he was actually the Rebbe, was that he told a bunch of people to go. There evidently used to be tashlich that was done in the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens, and he said that instead of you guys going at 2 o'clock, you guys going at 3 o'clock on Rosh Hashanah afternoon, because everyone should go together and everyone should sing Jewish songs as they're walking to the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens. The Rebbe, as we will come to see, and if we don't know already, was very into kind of like these public displays of Jewish pride. Not going out of your way to like create negative occurrences, but to always show how you're proud to be Jewish, and you never know who you could reach by doing that. So there was this in that first year, there was a whole chevra that walked to the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens together to do tashlich and Rosh Hashanah. And the way the story goes was that there was one Jew who saw them, and he was so inspired. He hadn't like kept anything in years, and he says, what are you guys doing? I know these songs from my youth, and as a result, I guess he ended up becoming like from or something because he was so inspired. So that was just like the introduction of the Rebbe into New York. By the year 1942, at the age of 40, the Rebbe took a regular, 9-to-5 job. He worked in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. His job specifically was to oversee the production of various ships that were used in World War II by America. And it's incredible. And obviously his engineering background was critical for this. Interestingly as well is that when he would speak about this in later years, which he infrequently did, when he would always mention that he had such pride that he was able to be involved in such important work to aid America in the fighting of the war, because he understood that, America was an incredible country. There are downfalls to America, obviously, but as Rav Moshe Feinstein said, that America was a Medina Shel Chesed, was an incredible country that welcomed in so many different types of people, and he had such pride that he was able to give back to the United States in that way. When Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak would always refer to his son-in-law, he would always refer to him not as the Rebbe, because he wasn't the Rebbe yet, so he would refer to him very famously as Ramash. What's Ramash? Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson. So he would always refer to him as that, and that's typically how he was referred to. If you know, we're not going to, there's just so much to go through, but all of the rabbis have like 5 different names, because between their actual name and the acronyms used, and their what was their name, and then what became their name, and so there's so many different ways to refer to it, but Ramash is one of the famous ways that Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak used to refer to his son-in-law, and others referred to him as well before he became the Rebbe. But in the year 1943, at the age of 41, the Ramash, Rav Menachem Mendel, publishes his very first sefer. It was called the book Hayom Yom. You've probably seen it at some point in your life. Hayom Yom in Hebrew or English, like it's like day by day or something. It was like the first real effort from Chabad, from Rav Menachem Mendel, to kind of enable people to have some sort of a daily study of Torah. So that was his first book, and it was from teachings from Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak. In the year 1944, when the Rebbe was 42, his father passes away in Kazakhstan after a terrible exile by the Russian government. In the year 1946, at the age of 44, November 14th, the Rebbe becomes an American citizen. That's interesting to note them. And in 1947, at the age of 45, the Rebbe finally was able to reunite with his mother. And after a series of bureaucratic red tape, he's able to bring his mother to America. It's interesting, well, not interesting, it's amazing, that once the Rebbe's mother comes to America, there are stories, and the Rebbe's mother used to brag about this, how he used to visit her every single day. He used to see her every single day. And on Friday, she would brag about it. He would visit her twice on Fridays. And true, he was distant from her for 20 years. They weren't in the same country, and there was obviously lots of terrible things going on in the world. But once she came to America, finally, he would see her daily, and he had tremendous respect, love, and affection for his mother. In the year 1950, when the Rabbi Nachum Mendel was 48, that's when his father-in-law, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, passed away. And this is, the next year or so, is very complicated. I guess nothing is complicated in comparison to what's going on now for the last 20-some-odd years with Lubavitch. But this was one of the more complicated times for Lubavitch, because there was a question who would be the next Lubavitch Rebbe, as we still have now. We're trying to figure out who the next Lubavitch Rebbe is going to be. So back then they were trying to figure that out as well after the sixth one passed away. So now who's going to be next? There were basically two options. There was Rabbi Nachum Mendel, who we'll see in a second was the clear choice, but there was a reason why he did not take it right away. And then there was his brother-in-law, Rabbi Gurari. I don't know if that's the right pronunciation, but his brother-in-law was also a potential option. There was a problem, however. It was clear, as we'll see in a moment, that Rabbi Nachum Mendel was the obvious choice. The problem was that because of what we saw previously, that he was always trying to avoid the limelight, he had no interest in being the Rebbe whatsoever, and so no one knew what to do. He wasn't going to take the position, and his brother-in-law, I'm sure he was great, but I guess he wasn't, you know, was not necessarily suited to be that, that sort of a figure. So it was very unclear what was going to happen. There's actually a really cute story one time after Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak passed away, the mailman who delivered, you know, mail to 770 in Crown Heights, he saw a whole bunch of like chassidim outside, you know, discussing, they were hacking, who's going to be the next rabbi, what are we going to do? And the mailman said, well, not a Jewish guy, what are you guys, you know, talking about? And they say, oh, you know, our teacher, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, passed away, and now we want to know who's going to be next to lead our cause, to lead our movement. And he said, oh, it's going to be Rabbi Nachum Mendel. How do you know? And so he said, because he gets much more mail than the other one. And so that's how he knew he was going to be leader. And okay, it was a bit prophetic. He knew that he was going to take over. But to show how against Rabbi Nachum Mendel was to becoming the next Rebbe, very famously, he would always wear gray suits. Right, a Hasidish Rebbe does not wear a gray suit. He wears a frock and a, you know, proper outfit. But he was always wearing gray suits, not on Shabbos and Yom Tov, because, you know, Kavod Shabbos and Kavod Yom Tov, maybe Rosh Chodesh also. I don't know. But he always made sure to wear a gray suit because he wanted to show that he was not going to take any sort of position. Obviously, that's soon undone. But that was just showing how he had no interest whatsoever. 8 months after the Rebbe's father-in-law passed away, there was essentially an acceptance by the Rebbe by Rabbi Nachum Mendel that he was going to become the Rebbe. Part of the reluctancy that the Rebbe had to becoming the next Rebbe, and I think this is critical to understand where the movement currently is now, is that he said, we still have a Rebbe. He said, our Rebbe may be not alive anymore, but he still is our Rebbe. And so that was part of the reluctance. He said, who am I to take over to be the next Rebbe when my father-in-law is still there? Okay, he's not alive, he's in heaven, but he still acts as a Rebbe. Not that he thought that he was alive, but that he thought that his teachings could still live on, right? So interestingly enough, that's a pretty normative Hasidish approach. If there is not someone who could take over to continue the movement, you continue to allow that rabbinic figure to lead the movement, as it were, not actually lead it, because they are dead, but from their teachings, you know, you still learn from them, and we still do that also, right? We don't say that the Rambam is still alive, we don't say that the Rabbi Soloveitchik is still alive, but we still continue to allow him to live through his teachings. It gets complicated when there's no one to take over the mantle, but that's still how we function, so whatever. I don't want to talk about current events with Chabad, but fine. Okay, so by the year 1951 or so, in January 17th, which was on the English calendar, the first year of Rav Yosef Yitzchak, Rav Menachem Mendel officially does become the Rebbe. And the way he did this was that he gave the first Maimar. A Maimar was essentially like a speech that you give. I'm sure that if Rabbi Kramer was here, he would get mad that I referred to it as just a speech, but it's really just a speech. It's a nice speech, but it's just a speech. By giving the Maimar, he showed that he was going to become the next Rebbe. It's also interesting to note that he sort of dropped the gray suit thing, I think, a few months prior, because it was clear that this is where he was headed, but that's how he sort of officially took over the mantle. To understand how committed the Rebbe was, as we mentioned him previously, from this point on, from the year 1951, he would die 43 years later. So he left New York City three times, only to go visit different Chabad locations in different areas in the tri-state area, but really never left. Not because he didn't like vacation or didn't like world travel. He did like world travel. He traveled a lot previously, you know, in the early years of his life. But it's because he literally didn't have a second. He was so immersed in leading this movement, and as we will see, as we know already, quite frankly, the incredible impact that he had. So that's why he never really left after this. So one of the first things, and I think this is really critical to note, that the Rebbe Nachum Mendel, who now we're just going to refer to him to him strictly as the Rebbe or the Rebbe, is that he at the very beginning of his taking this mantle of leadership, he establishes the Agudas Neshei Ubnos Chabad, which is basically a movement to empower female involvement among the movement. And the thought was that we need to continue to engage that side of the population to help them, you know, learn more Torah, stay connected. Interesting to note, you know, what we learned a month ago or so when we learned about Sar Schneer, the head of the Beis Yaakov movement, the starter of the Beis Yaakov movement. There was a clear understanding that women needed to be more involved. And this is something that we still continue to struggle with a little bit to this day. But he saw it as well, the Rebbe. In 1951, he said we need to create a space for women to be more involved. And so that's exactly what he did. And really his first major movement, or first major decree, as it were, as being the Rebbe. So fine. In 1953, the Rebbe begins to lay the foundation for what would become this like global mitzvah campaign that we still are reaping the benefits from. And so we start saying, you know, let's send people out to the street corners and we'll shake lulav and etzrog with people. And for Pesach that year, he sent a shmura matzah to people. Everyone got shmura matzah. And so that's when that really began in the year 1953. In the year 1958, this is the year that we'll live in. Not infamy, that's like a negative foundation. But it was a big year for the movement, because that is when the Rebbe started the Ufaratzta campaign. Anyone know what Ufaratzta campaign is? Ufaratzta means to like spread out. So the Rebbe started the Ufaratzta campaign, which was his way to really globalize Chabad. It's worthwhile noting that before this point, Lubavitch was like, it was just another Hasidic, like, I don't know, however we interact as with Satmar as a movement, or with like Belzer Chasinim, right? We're all familiar, I think, with these terms and with these groups. We don't really have anything to do with them. We all have something to do with Chabad. That started this year, because when the Rebbe said we have to be out there in the world, we have to be making a global impact, that's when Chabad began to get the name of like Chabad as we know it nowadays. We're not going to go through it now because there's just way too much. But basically, in source number 5, which is pages like 7 through 13. Thank you. This is an excerpt from Joseph Tulishkin's book. And there were 10 tenets that defined the Ufaratzta campaign. The first one was, you know, putting on tefillin. The second was the Neshek campaign, in which he told, you know, women to light Shabbos candles. That's when that became big. And there were several other elements to it as well. One of the major, major elements of it is sending Chabad Shluchim to different places. This was not the first time ever that the Shaliach was sent somewhere, but this was really when he started to double down on this mission of sending Shluchim around the world, and obviously the rest is history. The world as we know it nowadays is unimaginable without Chabad Shluchim. You can imagine not going somewhere in the world and not knowing what you're going to do for a kosher Chabad, whatever they are. They're literally everywhere. And that all started in this year when he saw the critical need for Jews, I think probably mostly secular, but really all Jews, right? It's hard to believe that he had the intention to give the guy who's vacationing in Puerto Rico to give him a good steak for a Shabbos dinner. It's hard to believe that was his intention, but it's a nice benefit that comes out of the campaign, which was to reach every Jew all across the world. Okay, fine. So that's the Ufaratzta campaign, which he started when he was 56 years old, in the year 1958. In the year 1964, at the age of 62, the Rebbe's mother passed away, and obviously, as we said before, this was a difficult blow for the Rebbe, because he was very close with his mother, he had an incredible amount of respect for her, and the fact that she passed away was just difficult for him, needless to say. But, you know, she was at an old ripe age, and so, you know, these things do happen at some point. So he moved on. But her presence in America was critical for him for the rest of his life. In the year 1967, at the age of 65, so this was during the Six-Day War, which was obviously a very difficult time for the Jewish world. So the Rebbe seemingly now was the time in which he started really saying how critical tefillin wearing was, and it's really around the times of the Six-Day War, I think, that he said people have to start putting tefillin on all the time, just to help, you know, be marbitz mitzvos, to do more mitzvahs. So that's when I think he started sending people to street corners to put tefillin on, and that, again, the rest is history with that. In the year 1973, at the age of 71, Chabad started this, or the Rebbe started the Chanukah campaign, right? So we all, no one can have Chanukah without having Chabad somewhere involved, whether it's a lighting in a public square, whether it's someone going on top of a cherry picker and lighting whatever. People think, I mean, it's incredible what Rabbi Kramer does here, but he's not, literally every Chabad does that in every single town in the world. Right? They all go on the cherry pickers and they all act like they're the only ones doing this, but really you go 10 minutes that way or that, you know, they're all doing it. And that was really started by the Rebbe. It's a little controversial, it's worthwhile noting that this campaign that began in this year in 1971 to light everywhere. The idea of lighting in a public town square is not something that is halakhically really precedented. Right? Never before did we ever light in a town square. We always lit in our homes. We always lit in our shuls. We always lit in the Beis HaMikdash. We never lit in the town square. So the fact that this became a thing that Chabad did, although it's incredible, and you see the Parsuminisa, right, the publicization of the miracle is amazing, but it's unclear how they're able to make brachos. This is not a halachic discussion, but it is worthwhile to note that that is a little complicated, how that takes place. So that's the year, 1973, at the age of 71 for the Rebbe. In the year 1977, when the Rebbe is 75, so this is the first major health blow that the Rebbe Nachman Mendel Schneerson experiences, and that is that he has a very big heart attack. When they were dancing for the kafos on the Simchas Torah, and so he was hospitalized, and amazingly he recovers, bounces back incredibly well, and so much so that the doctors of the time, his doctor, said that they had never seen someone who had a heart attack of that caliber recuperate to the extent that he did, because he just like quadruples his efforts the rest of his life, and so it's really remarkable. Doesn't 100% expected from Lubavitcher Rebbe, but it is still incredible to note that he was a human and he was able to do that. Okay, so fine. So in 1978, this is where we begin to see, I'm sure there were previous involvements, but it's where we on a historical level are able to see the total global impact that the Lubavitcher Rebbe had, and specifically we see that because in the year 1978, the Rebbe pushed that there should be a cabinet position for the president of the United States. The cabinet position should be the Department of Education. That's someone who's in charge of the Department of Education in America, that they should be on the president's cabinet, and to this day, that still is a position, to my knowledge. And that was really done, that was made possible by the Rebbe's lobbying to someone, and he was the one to make sure this happened. This was such a critical thing, and he was so involved that to this day, the what's called Education, and now it's called Education and Sharing Day, is a day on the American calendar every single year. And when, anyone know when it takes place? It takes place on the 11th of Nisan every single year. It has a different English date every single year, but it was established in honor of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. You look at the official American calendar every single year. Congress passes it as a bill. It's one of the bills that no one really looks at anymore. But it's but every single year, the president since the year 1978 has always agreed to the establishment of Education Day for that year on whatever the English date is that associates with the 11th Nisan. Look on it's his birthday. It was in honor of his birthday. So for the past 50 years or so, this has been something that was started by President Jimmy Carter in honor of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So it's amazing to kind of think of it like that. In the year 1980, when the Rebbe was already 78 years old, so you see how there's like this continuous inching forward to do more and more as he became, more lofty and more well-known. So he started it's unclear to me exactly how much of a campaign this was, but he started what was called the Sheva Mitzvos campaign, and that is that we know that in Judaism we believe that all Jews should be doing all the mitzvos, but that we also believe in Judaism that all non-Jews should be doing all the seven mitzvos b'nei Noach. And so how do you make that happen? So you become the Lubavitcher Rebbe and you start the Sheva Mitzvos campaign. So the Sheva Mitzvos campaign essentially was his desire and push to make sure that all non-Jews were keeping these seven mitzvos. So if you take a look at source number 6, he did just that. And he had, in 1985, when Education Day was designated for that year to be April 2nd, in the preamble over here, let's see what paragraph it's in. Okay, yeah, so take a look at the second paragraph. Whereas these ethical values and principles have been the bedrock of society from the dawn of civilization, when they were known as the seven Noahide laws, whereas without these ethical values and principles, the edifice of civilization stands in serious peril of returning to chaos, whereas society is profoundly concerned with the recent weakening of these principles that has resulted in crises that beleaguer and threaten in the fabric of civilized society. So essentially, right, so the U.S. House of Representatives wrote this in the preamble for this designation of the of Education Day for that year, that the Congress recognized the notion of the seven Noahide laws. So that's just another incredible thing that he was able to accomplish. In the year 1986, when the Rebbe was 84, so basically by the time the Rebbe reached around the age of 80, he stopped doing what's called like a yechidus, to have a one-on-one meeting with the Rebbe. He stopped doing that, and by the age of 84, a few years later, is when he started doing something that he would become famous for as well, and that is giving out dollars. So that was the year he started giving out dollars, and it was every single like late Sunday morning, if I understand correctly, and every single Sunday he would give out $6,000 to $8,000, somewhere in that range. So he saw a lot of people. And the way the story goes is that one time, so the line was obviously very long if you're giving out $8,000 in a few hours. The story goes is that there was an older woman on the line, I guess around the Rebbe's age, he was 84, and she said, how are you able to do this? How are you able to wait up to, because he used to stand up the entire time, and it was several hours. So she said, I had trouble waiting online. How could you do this? And he said, what do you mean? When people are counting diamonds, they don't get tired. And I'm counting diamonds right now with all the yidden that are passing before. Man, it's like a cute story, but it's true. So I don't get tired at all from counting these diamonds that come before me every single Sunday. Okay, by a few years later, in 1988, at the age of 86, so Rebbe Chaim Mushka passes away. It's the shift in terms of the Rebbe's role was just multiplied after this. He had a very special relationship with his Rebbetzin, but once she passed away, it sort of enabled him to kind of just fully be encompassed by the movement in a way that even that point he had not really fully been. He used to give a Fabringen every like once a month or twice a month, but then it on Friday nights. But then that went to every single week, and he just kind of like, you know, once he didn't have a, it's like weird to say, but he didn't have much of a personal life, I guess, and so he seems like he immersed himself just fully, even more so in his movement. There's a cute story that, so if anyone's ever met any Lubavitch family, which I think we all have, you know that the average Lubavitch family, among their kids, there's always a Chaim Mushka, and there's always a Menachem Mendel. So Menachem Mendel is named after the Rebbe, and Chaim Mushka is named after his wife. And there was a push from when she passed away already for people to name after her. So on the first yahrzeit of Rebbe Tzin Chaim Mushka, there was an album that was handed to the Rebbe of these beautiful 324 new baby girls that all had the name Chaim Mushka in the Chabad movement, which is like a cute story. It's worthwhile noting that the Rebbe was a big spreader of the idea that we want Mashiach now, that's something that we want. And unfortunately, the Meshuggahs nowadays, they kind of ruin Mashiach for a lot of people. Because we as a Jewish nation, we hopefully everyone at this table desires Mashiach. Why do I say that? Because that's one of the 13 principles of faith, that we believe that Mashiach is coming and that he will, God willing, be here very, very soon, today, tomorrow, that he should come right away. And so the Rebbe was very into trying to bring Mashiach, but in a somewhat uncharacteristic approach to the matter. So the Rebbe in 1992, on March 2nd, 1992, he was speaking to his movement, and he says as follows, it's unbelievable. He says, what more can I do to motivate the entire Jewish people to cry out and demand that Mashiach should come? All that has been done until now has not helped. We are still in exile. I have done everything I can. From now on, you must do whatever you can. Now, all of you must do all that you can to actually bring Mashiach here and now immediately. So it's somewhat uncharacteristic for the Rebbe at the age of 90. He said that because you see that at that point, he begins to seemingly lay some sort of groundwork for realization that he will not be on this world forever. And he says, I can't bring Mashiach anymore. You guys have to bring Mashiach now. But again, it's worthwhile to note that he didn't say, I am Mashiach. He said, you have to bring Mashiach. So the assumption is that he did not think that he was Mashiach. Okay, that's just one of the trillion reasons why he's not the Mashiach. Okay, fine. So in the year 1992, when the Rebbe was 90, is I guess sometime after this, the Rebbe had a very, very bad stroke while he was visiting the Ohel. The Ohel is where his father-in-law is buried as well. He had a terrible stroke, which left him, I believe, without the ability to walk ever again. On June 12th of 1994, just 2 years later, on the 3rd of Tammuz, the Rebbe passes away. And it's worthwhile noting lots of things. But it's worthwhile noting that the impact of his presence in, on this planet is pretty unprecedented in terms of how much of a reach he was able to have. Again, you take away all the narishka, you take away all the messianism, you take away, I don't know if people are familiar with, but the book by Dr. David Berger from Revel about how Chabad is like Christianity, and because of, they believe that the Rebbe is going to resurrect himself, right? It doesn't look very good for them. But if you take away all that narishkeit, and you just talk about the man of Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson himself, the impact that he had is amazing. If you take a look at source number 7, Chabad does a very good job of fundraising and letting us know that they do have an impact, which is to their credit as well. So they have 49, on their website, it says they have 4,900 Chabad Lubavitch emissary families around the world that operate a total of 3,500 Jewish institutions in 100 countries and territories in all 50 states. They're on over 500 campuses, college campuses. There is not a single other Jewish organization that comes anywhere near the impact that Chabad has been able to have, and that is entirely due to what the Rebbe had told his Hasidim to be a part of. So again, all like the narishkeit that kind of comes with the Chabad movement and all the messianism, whatever, that we see unfortunately nowadays, which hopefully that number is dwindling, but I don't think it is. But we have to kind of separate the man from the crazies. Right? Every movement has a couple of crazies, but the man himself was a gadol and an unbelievable, life-changing, world-changing individual who to this day continues to impact our lives. And I would say that there are several takeaways from his life, but perhaps just to offer three specific takeaways. One is that you can't learn about the Lubavitcher Rebbe and not realize how much he loved every single Jew and how much he loved every single person. Right? His involvement in American politics, and in terms of establishing, having Education Day established in the Department of Education, being a cabinet position, his desire to help and love all people is something that we can all obviously learn from. I would say number two, an understanding of appreciating whoever your rabbi or your rebbe, whatever it is, it's also critical here. He viewed his father-in-law as the rebbe. Okay, he eventually became the rebbe himself, but he always had an appreciation and a kavod for the rebbe. And it is something that Chabad and Chassidus in general, that they are able to make their rebbe lift him up and put him on this pedestal, not in a negative way, but in a very positive way. So that's something that we could probably do a little bit better at. And number three, to realize that the Rebbe did want more than anything to bring Mashiach, and that was part and parcel of all that he did in his life, and that we should also, right? Everyone makes fun of the Chabadniks, everyone makes fun of how they all talk about Mashiach and they're messianists, whatever, but at least they're trying to bring Mashiach. When was the last time someone said, I am trying to bring Mashiach, and they weren't part of the Chabad movement? Right? That has to be part of our end goal here. We believe in Judaism that there's going to be a redemption, there's going to be a rebuilding of the third base of English, that Mashiach is going to come, and that should really be part of our lives as well. We shouldn't be messianists, we shouldn't say that someone who's dead is going to be Mashiach, but what we should say is that we want Mashiach to come now, and we have to do whatever we can to make that happen. So anyways, that was just a little bit about the life of Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the seventh and most recent Lubavitcher Rebbe. And I thank you everyone for listening, and have a great day. Yeah.